from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Imagine two groups of college students, one white, one black. They're both about to test their golf skills. Before the test begins, the white students are told it's a test of natural athletic ability. The black students are told the golf challenge is a test of strategic intelligence. Neither do as well as groups that don't get those same instructions. What's going on? In a provocative new book, psychologist Claude Steele outlines how powerful stereotypes can affect our behavior. We'll find out more after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Another school year is about to begin, and it probably won't be long before we see another set of test scores that point to an enduring and perplexing problem, the achievement gap, the divide that still exists between how white, black, and Latino students perform on standardized tests. In a fascinating new book called Whistling Vivaldi, and we'll get to what that title means in just a moment, social psychologist Claude Steele provides a tantalizing explanation for part of what may be in play, the role of stereotypes. Steele presents intriguing study after intriguing study, which points to how students behave when they feel the power of a particular stereotype hanging over them. Claude Steele is currently the provost at Columbia University. He also served on the faculties of the University of Michigan and Stanford University, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's begin with the question of that achievement gap, that perpetually frustrating problem that I think we will no doubt read about again. Give us sort of your kind of brief guide to why that has been such an enduring problem and some of the usual – and you add an intriguing layer to an explanation. But what are some of the usual reasons that are offered for why that gap has been so persistent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's – the way I think about it is that there really are – after having done this research is that one part of the gap is caused by the processes or rooted in the processes that we've studied. But the other part, and perhaps the biggest part, are, I think, attributable to causes that people are more familiar with, that race and social class are still factors that affect how educational resources are distributed in society. And so African-American communities, Latino communities, lower income communities in general do not have the quality of educational opportunity that others enjoy in this society. That kind of thing, the distress that families in those communities can be under, the kind of distracting peer group effects that those students can have to contend with, these things probably make up the biggest source of those gaps. They reflect our history as a society being organized in part around race, social class, having a long tradition of resources, the quality of those resources being affected by these things. These things visit us in the present day in the form of an achievement gap, and I think the biggest part of it is there.
And part of what you've added to this equation that's intriguing gets at one of the problems that on the surface at least, seems like such a head-scratcher, and that is that if you look at high test scores, high SAT scores, for example, of African-American students going off to prestigious universities, they still wind up performing often lower than their white counterparts with similar SAT scores. And that led you in part into exploring what else might be going on.
Yes. That was the problem that launched the work behind this book and the story. The book is told in a narrative that kind of you look over the investigator's shoulder as we encounter one kind of peculiar fact after another. And that was the first one, that students who had obviously strong skills and abilities and so on were underperforming, is the term that's used in these competitive academic environments. And that was surprising to me because that couldn't be so easily attributed to the problems I just talked about. These were students who had survived those problems and still, for some reason, were underperforming.
So how did you go about coming to this idea that there might be something else in play? One of the examples you give is taking a group of students, both black and white, as they're about to take a test, the grad record exam, the GREs, very difficult and sophisticated test, and you discovered that how people would perform on that would differ markedly depending what they were told up front. Describe what those students were told, black students in particular, and what that began to form in your mind in terms of what else was going on.
Yeah, it turned out to be quite simple. When they understood the test to be a test of their cognitive abilities, they underperformed. When they understood exactly the same test to be a puzzle that was not diagnostic of their abilities, they performed just as well as equally skilled white students in that situation. So that's the one of the basic findings, is that when the test was understood to be a test of cognitive abilities, the stereotype about African Americans and their intellectual ability was relevant to them. So it may sound unusual, but when you're taking a test and you're under the pressure of that stereotype, of confirming it or possibly being seen in terms of that stereotype, they would try hard. And the extra trying was essentially a kind of multitasking that interfered with their performance on the test. The same kind of phenomenon happens for women in advanced math courses and on very difficult math exams. They, too, are a group who has a negative stereotype out there about their abilities.
And describe when you've tested that or your colleagues elsewhere have tested that, again, this example of what was said to them in one instance and then what was said to them in another.
Yeah. In the case of one of the early experiments looking at this phenomenon in women, we told them as they sat down to take a very difficult test. And that's critical. The test has to be difficult. It's at the frontier of their skills, and they have to be women or African Americans, in the case of this research, who are committed to succeeding in the area of the test. That's important. That's what makes the pressure of that stereotype felt, is that you want to succeed, and you don't want to be seen in terms of that stereotype, and so you're bearing down extra hard, but that extra bearing down is essentially a multitasking, as well as causing a lot of physiological arousal, a lot of allocation of brain activities in a disadvantageous way, and so on. So we told women as they sat down to take this test, this in one instance, this is a test of cognitive abilities. They underperformed. Or we told them, this is a test that women always do as well as men. And there's nothing you could do on this test that could confirm anything about your being a woman. You could confirm that you as an individual are not good at math, but not that you're not good at math because of something about your being a woman. And with that instruction, women perform just as well as equally skilled men on the test. That relieves them of that stereotype pressure.
Part of what's fascinating about this, I think, is that it cuts across race and gender. These aren't just powerful stereotypes. So often when we talk about these things, we think in terms of, okay, these are stereotypes that affect this one group of people. What's interesting about your work in part is that it cuts across in so many different ways. One of my favorite examples was the golf example.
Yeah.
Describe that.
Yeah. This is looking at the effects of these stereotype pressures on athletic performance and an experiment done by a group at Princeton under Jeff Stone's direction had people take elite athletes do a golf task, 10 holes of golf in the laboratory room, and they were told, these are white and black athletes, and they were told just before they began the golf task in one condition of the experiment that this is a test of natural athletic ability. Mm-hmm. Well, making it a test of natural athletic ability raises for the white athletes a negative stereotype. And sure enough, they underperform on that golf task. They go in there and as they experience frustrations, it threatens to confirm the stereotype. They're concerned about their dedicated athletes and they get jangled and don't perform as well. Importantly and intriguingly, you can turn the tables by presenting that golf task, the same golf task, with a different instruction. This time, in the other condition, they told them just before they began the task that this is a task, a measure of sports strategic intelligence. Well, that raises a stereotype about African Americans, and they feel now that their frustrations could be confirming that stereotype or could cause them to be confirm that stereotype, and they get nervous and underperform and perform worse in that condition than the white athlete. So the who performs on top is reversed by which stereotype is relevant.
So is it your general sense that in schools, be they elementary, high school, or in colleges, that this power of stereotype, the threat of doing something that would reinforce a stereotype, has a real actual effect on behavior? This isn't just a laboratory phenomenon, that this is something that gets at this ongoing problem of underperformance?
Yes, I do. The laboratory experiments are good for demonstrating it and giving you a chance to tear it apart in a laboratory and see what's behind it. So years of research have gone into just exactly what kind of how it interferes with brain function, how it affects cardiac reactivity, how it affects the allocation of attention and so on. So we can study it in the laboratory that way. But it's really important to understand that in real life, these groups and the stereotypes about them are part of their chronic experience in a classroom or a school, especially as they push forward in the area. For example, looking at women in mathematics, they might not feel it very much at the high school level when women are doing just as well as men and there are just as many women in the math courses as there are men. But when you get into the higher level college classes, graduate school, and those environments get more male-oriented, the stereotype pressure becomes more important and it becomes a chronic feature of their lives. And then you have a president of a famous university like Larry Summers say something that confirms that reinforces that climate and it reinforces the pressure. It's important to stress that I'm not referring to here to prejudice on the part of people on teachers or administrators or anybody else in the environment. I'm talking about the effects of our stereotypes, the broader stereotypes in society, just the existence of those stereotypes can have.
Claude Steele, the provost at Columbia University, author of the new book Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us. Promised I'd explain the title, Whistling Vivaldi.
Yeah. It's a great story told by Brent Staples, who is an African-American. He's an editorialist for the New York Times now. When he went to graduate school at the University of Chicago years ago, dressed like a student, walking down the streets of Hyde Park, he noticed that whites, he made them nervous. And they'd kind of look away from him or maybe even cross the street to avoid him and so on. And it became clear to him that he was being seen through the lens of a stereotype about African-Americans as perhaps a potentially menacing person. This was got to be quite an obstruction in his life. He tells it beautifully in his own autobiography, Parallel Time. But he came upon a strategy that fixed the problem in the short term at any rate, which is to simply whistle Vivaldi.
And suddenly people appeared or took in his appearance in a very different way.
Yeah, yeah. A menacing black gang member does not whistle Vivaldi going down the street. So it was a very effective strategy, but it illustrates perfectly the power of the phenomenon, the kind of effect it can have on a person's life, and so on.
And you talk about this some, too, in your own life experience. When you were a graduate student at The Ohio State University as an African-American graduate student and the role in particular that your advisor, mentor, played there. And this gets at something I think that's also really interesting about the way in which advisors can affect, teachers can affect, the way in which those stereotypes get broken down. What did your advisor do for you, and how have you begun to look at that phenomenon within the college environment?
Yeah, that's very important because this begins to address the issue of what can you do about these pressures. And I did experience them going to graduate school as one of the only African-American in my entire graduate program in psychology and maybe most the other social sciences. This was back in the day, as they say, the late 60s, early 70s. And there were lots of cues around being the one minority there, being an environment that was all about how smart you were, and me being exhibit A of a group whose intelligence was under some serious suspicion in those days, especially. So I felt that pressure. My advisor, however, as time went by, I don't think he was particularly sophisticated about these things, but he was coming up for tenure. I don't know if I talk about this in the book or not.
There's a pressure.
Yeah. And I was his only graduate student, and he had to believe in me, and he did. And I could tell, looking in his eyes, that this was a person that believed I could do this work. And he demanded a huge amount out of me. There was not a lot of praise. It wasn't a particularly warm relationship. It was a comfortable relationship. He demanded a lot out of me, and he affirmed my ability to do it. And I could tell from that combination of things that he wasn't seeing me stereotypically. And it enabled me to feel comfortable in that environment, that I could be appreciated there. And I think that begins to be a strategy that undoes some of this pressure in schooling situations.
And it relates, I think, particularly to something you also discuss, which is the way in which feedback is delivered. And you talk about how Black students in particular are more responsive to certain kinds of feedback than others, and that it's not enough to just sort of give attaboys, that there needs to be something more than that. And you describe a particular situation about how their work was critiqued, and when that critique was framed in one way, it had a much more effective response.
Yes, that was an experiment done by Jeff Cohen, who is currently a professor at Stanford. This was his dissertation when he was a student at Stanford. And he gave feedback to Black and white Stanford students on essays they'd written about their favorite professor. And they came back a couple of days later and got feedback, and he was interested in, depending on how he gave the feedback, would that affect how much they believed it and how motivated they were by it. And what he found was that when you gave the feedback very directly, like, well, here's the critique of the essay you wrote, or when he added a very positive bromide up front, like, well, you're a very wonderful person, I know you're a great person, but here's the feedback. African-American students didn't believe it. They didn't trust it. And not trusting it, they weren't as motivated by it. That, I think, is a powerful finding in its own right, because it shows how the identity of being Black in that situation. You don't know whether the critical feedback is coming from your work or from maybe somebody seeing you stereotypically. It ambiguates the situation. You believe things less. You're less motivated by it. So that's a feature of that. But the form of feedback that worked was like that of my advisor, where the feedback said, look, I've read your essay, and I have some critical feedback. We have very high standards we're using in evaluating these essays, but I think you can meet those standards. Then the African-American students were astoundingly motivated. I mean, 75% of them took the essays home to work in them, and this was just an experiment. This wasn't a course for credit.
So what's going on there? What do you think is tripping the trigger in a different way?
Well, I think that's a powerful form of feedback for any of us. It can direct our lives when somebody says, look, I've looked at your work. I think you can do it. And we use high standards, and I think you can meet those standards. That's something that tells us that we're seen as having the requisite capacities to do some important line of work. So I think it's powerful for all of us, and I think it's something that in interracial situations, student-teacher relationships or boss-worker relationships or manager relationships, it's rare. We're too distant to give that kind of feedback.
And that's where
the problems arise.
And it's not about being nice, right? It's not about saying, you know, pat on the back. It's not about saying, I think you're a swell person. It's about saying, we've got some work to do here, but we're about doing the very best. I think we can get there. Let's work on this.
Yes, exactly. It was my advisor. I don't remember him giving me a lot of praise, and it wasn't that I didn't want it. I wanted it, but we were task focused, and it was clear he thought I could do it.
This connects up in some ways to another phenomenon you describe, which I found really interesting, which is the way in which different students study, and that different race groups study in a different way, and that
yes.
Black students in particular, you found, tend to study alone. Why is that important?
I think this comes from the work done at Berkeley by Yuri Treisman, who used to be there. He's now at Texas, and he ran very effective math workshops that are – he won the MacArthur Prize for the work he did there, enabling black students to perform very well in calculus. And he found, though, that they studied – this is what led to his program. He followed them around in their dorms and so on, and he found that they studied long hours by themselves and too nervously. They would keep going to the back of the book to check the answers, and they were spending, by doing that, not enough time on the concepts and too much time on the arithmetic and not getting the concepts of calculus. This is all about – this was in his calculus course. Other groups, Asians and whites, were spending a lot more time outside of class talking to each other about the problems and getting the concepts. So they just it just happened so much faster for them because of the way in which they studied and the way they used each other to study. So he simply took what they did and created groups for blacks to do the same thing, and lo and behold, their performance soared like that. So why were they studying so much under all alone like that? My interpretation would be it's the pressure of that stereotype that you are going to really – your parents have told you to try double hard, and that's what you're going to do. And you're not even going to waste time talking to other people about it. And you don't want to risk showing people that you don't know because they might see you stereotypically. And so that stereotype threat creates this maladaptive – way of studying, and that's what he was able to break through.
Is part of what's appealing, excuse me, is part of what's appealing about this that it offers suggestions for what can be done, that it's not as frustratingly perplexing if we come up with some of these solutions like study groups. I mean, these sound like doable activities.
Yes. Yeah, I'm particularly happy with the role that these processes seem to play in the achievement gap and phenomenon like that, because I think they're fixable. Some of the things that the achievement gap is attributed to are not so fixable, and that's depressing. And I think it makes us even shy to talk about these problems. This diagnosis, however, is fixable. I think you have to begin with the strategy, with understanding that students who are under the threat of these stereotypes, women in advanced math, white guys in advanced basketball.
Can they jump?
Can they do it? Can they really, you know, handle that pressure and so on? African Americans in academic context. I think we have to understand that their identities and the stereotypes about them put them under this kind of pressure, and that what they need to succeed in those situations is first a sense that they're safe there, that they can trust the situation, that they're not at risk all the time of being seen stereotypically. And then they can engage the work for its own sake and get motivated in it. So as a strategy, I think that's the first point that needs to be made. Our research and that of my colleagues over the years, I think, is making amazing progress in finding tactics, particular things that can be done to alleviate these pressures and situations.
Claude Steele, again, his new book is called Whistling Vivaldi. When we come back, we'll talk more about what some of those tactics can be, what might be done to break apart the achievement gap and begin to make progress in some of these areas. We're also going to talk about affirmative action, what we know about that, what makes a difference in those programs as well. And we'd like to hear from you. Well, how have stereotypes perhaps played a role in your life? What have you done to work around those? What sort of advice or consulting support did you get that made a difference? We'd like to hear your thoughts on your experiences with this as well. Here's the number if you want to join us. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments there, and we'll fold them in to our conversation. Back with Claude Steele and more about the power of stereotypes in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Claude Steele is our guest this hour. He's the provost at Columbia University, also a renowned social psychologist, the author of a new book called Whistling Vivaldi about the power of stereotypes and how they affect all of us and the way in which we behave. We'd like to hear your stories as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments online. Before we get to our calls, Claude Steele, I'd like you to tell the story of affirmative action, the court decision that was made in the case involving the University of Michigan, where you once were. And I want to ask it because I think there's a lot of frustration sometimes about affirmative action programs. Why do we still need them? What is it about them that might still be relevant? And you tell the story about listening to an interview with Sandra Day O'Connor. You heard it on your car radio. And you said you knew when you heard that interview how she felt.
I did. I thought, that I know what she's going to do. The issue had come down to, this was an interview not about the affirmative action decisions, but about her, it was a book she'd written, which is an autobiography. And she was talking a lot about her experience on the court, her life experiences, and then her life on the court. And she began to describe how much pressure she felt when she was the only woman on the court. The Michigan case, I should point out, was a case based on critical mass. The argument was that in order for minority students to be comfortable enough to thrive in a competitive academic environment, it was important to have a critical mass, not to be just a tiny minority, but to have some sizable number. I talk about the complexity of setting that number precisely in the book, but for the time being, that was what the issue was. So their whole case was based on this critical mass. She starts talking about how the press hounded her, how every decision was looked at from how does a woman think about this? How does is she too feminist? Is she not feminist enough?
And she was operating under the power of a stereotype.
Yeah, she was operating under the power of a stereotype. Then one day, Ruth Bader Ginsburg arrived. And she says, you know, we disagreed on many things, but it was completely transformed my life. Yeah. It just took that pressure away. Now there are two women, and you see us solely through a single stereotype like that. And so the pressure went away, and we thrived. Then, of course, eventually Sandra Day O'Connor leaves, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg is left alone in the court, and she too says almost the same thing. We disagreed on many things, but I can't tell you how lonely it is, and how much I don't want it to be the case that people think that you should have only one woman at a time on the Supreme Court, and how stressful it was for her. So it's a good example of how an element in a situation, just the number of other people we are around, can make an effect on this pressure.
That there's safety in numbers. I mean, part of your argument in all of this is creating safe environments. You quote Arthur Ashe at one point as saying that whenever he gave a speech or was in a public situation, he always counted.
Yeah.
He always looked out to see how many black or brown faces were there. And that matters, whether it's the numbers in your student body, the numbers in a class you're taking, the numbers of black faculty members.
Yeah, absolutely. In all of our identities, my son is a musician, plays in clubs sometimes, and I go in at my advanced age, 60s, and I count. How many other older guys are there around here? And if I can see a couple, I feel a little more comfortable.
Let's hear what our callers are thinking about this. Michael in San Francisco joins us first. Michael, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Am I on radio?
You're on. Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. This is kind of interesting because I felt the same way. I was traveling back from the West Bank, Ramallah, through Israel, Tel Aviv, and I've done it a couple of times. And being an Arab going back, a lot of questions come up of where you're coming from, why you're here, what you're traveling for, and you get interrogated, kind of questioned and searched. And the last time I was coming back, last October, I had my CDs with me in the case, and the kid, 20-year-old kid searching me, go to a special area. He said, what are these for? I said, they're my CDs. What do you do? Oh, I'm a DJ. And he said, okay. And then we started talking about the group in San Francisco. In fact, it mushroomed with an Israeli group. And he saw them in Israel. He knows them. And then all of a sudden, he's telling me how Amish wants to come to Israel. He's being very comfortable with me. At the end of the conversation, he goes, I'm really sorry. I have to search you now. So let me do my business. I said, no problem. So he went ahead and searched me, and he thanked me. And then I went to his boss, and I said, hey, you know, I'm commending this work. He did a good job. He goes, thank you very much. And we all went our way, and I went to the plane and went back. So the whole attitude completely changed once he, you know, saw me as a DJ, not as an Arab or something, because you never meet a lot of people like me. So that was very interesting for me.
Michael, thanks.
Yeah. I think seeing people behind the stereotype of them is really an important experience that a lot of us, I think, have had. And I think it's an important skill to develop, to be able to see the individual behind the stereotype. There's a very famous work by Irving Goffman, a sociologist who used to be at Berkeley, interviewing gays in the 50s. And they used the term wise when they would refer to somebody who could see them as individuals without seeing them stereotypically, who could see past the stereotype of the group. And I think that's a great example of that kind of experience.
And Michael's story also gets at something else you describe in the book, which is the importance of being able to make connections. You cite at one point the figure that most people, vast majority of people, wind up getting their jobs because of certain connections and acquaintances. So that means that if we're going to be able to open up prospects for people of color, that there have to be opportunities to cross those divides and make those connections.
That's so true that when the segregation of relationships can have real economic consequences because they put us outside of networks that along which jobs and opportunities travel. There's a sociologist at Stanford, Mark Greneventer, has a beautiful paper some years ago called The Strength of Weak Ties, that most of us hear about our jobs from not from our close friends but from our acquaintances who are in a somewhat different world than we are and pick up opportunities for us.
And you mention also studies that have shown that when people are asked to list their best friends, they're all of the same color. I can't remember the statistic exactly, but it's very few black students have many white friends and vice versa on campus.
Yeah. As much progress as we've made, and I don't want to diminish that racial progress as we've made in this society, and I don't want to diminish that in any way, our social relationships are still awfully structured around race and social class. These are powerful organizers.
Chris in Oakland has our next question. Chris, go ahead.
It's a comment on something you said. I mean, I can't jump, and I do really well on standardized tests. And I'm about the same age as the professor, and I went to one of the local law schools, and we had a very large LEOP population, Legal Equal Opportunity Program. And in contrast to what he was talking about, we observed that the African-American students studied in groups, but they used 16 different study aids. And as part of a couple of big strikes and stuff, and one of the things we were very critical of the administration of is that they didn't provide some guidance that pick one and use it. Don't use 16 different outline study aids, et cetera, and try to use all of them because you'll never keep track of all that stuff.
Chris, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's an interesting situation. It sounds like an inefficient strategy there that could have been easily corrected. You know, from just that brief story, I don't want to diagnose it too easily, but it is an inefficiency which I think could have been corrected.
A couple of emails coming in. Christine writes, I will always remember the African-American man who addressed a gathering at my husband's 30th college reunion. This man, who had earned a number of graduate degrees and who had led a life of great accomplishment, rose to formally thank his advisor at the college. He explained that the advisor, when realizing that this young man would be the only African-American at this small liberal arts college, made it clear to him that he would be socially out of place and that he would not be able to be academically successful. He said that conversation lit a fire in his belly that had driven him through all his studies and his achievements. So that's coming at it sort of a different way, and that's something that a lot of people feel like, well, damn it, I'm gonna prove this guy wrong. I'm gonna overcome those stereotypes. What's your reaction to that? Because that's a common reaction too.
Yeah, that's a common reaction. I talk about this at some length in the book. That's certainly the advice my father gave me. Ignore the stereotypes or use them as a source of motivation to achieve. I think that's what's going on in our experiments, for example, that people are trying really hard to overcome the stereotype. Where it starts to be, it's a problem in two ways, though, when you think about it over the course of things. The first way is that in the immediate situation, it means you're multitasking and not just involved in the task at hand. In addition to the task at hand, you're involved in monitoring how well you're doing in relation to the stereotype and whether you're trying hard enough and so on. So you've got that extra kind of distraction going on, which we find vivid evidence in terms of brain imaging studies that show how that looks, what that looks like in our attentional capacities.
Blood pressure, right?
Blood pressure is up. You're doing a lot more, and that makes it harder to perform. The second problem is that that's hard to sustain over a long period of time. And people,
exhausting.
It's exhausting. And people can recoil from that whole course of life where they're going to have to live like that, trying doubly hard and then not completely succeeding and so on. So even though I think you hear these stories all the time, and I myself can give them, I think it exacts such a cost that it can be defeating.
Bryce in Burlingame wants to join the conversation. Bryce, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have a couple of questions, sort of at different ends of the age spectrum. First, I'm curious if you've looked at how early these stereotypes sink in with kids early on in life, begin to affect their performance. And then at the other end, have you studied or have there been studies on the effect of affirmative action possibly having the unintended consequence of actually enforcing these stereotypes?
Great questions. The first one, there is a considerable amount of research finding stereotype threat in children as early as 5 years old, for example, girls in math. Again, the effect, a stereotype threat is it's important to give just a definition here that I think can be useful. It's the perception that I could be stereotyped. I could be seen negatively based on a given identity I have. It could be my age, my sexual orientation, my race, my social class. Or we can experience stereotype threat in a variety of ways. And even at a very early age, we can have some sense that perhaps because I'm the only person of this identity in this classroom or a small number, that I could be seen in negative ways based on that. And so when those in those kinds of circumstances, children as early as 5 years old can show this. There's a famous doll studies by Kenneth Clark, which I think were actually there's a documentary on CNN last night about revisiting the doll studies. Showing kids as young as 4 years old can have some sense of some apprehension over the possibility of being seen in terms of negative stereotypes.
And just briefly, as I understood that, that's as simple as showing a girl a picture of a girl holding a doll can then affect how well she does on a math test?
Yes.
Is that it?
Yeah. Yes. These studies just had children color in pictures of a girl holding a doll or a neutral picture. And the young kids who colored in the doll picture scored lower on the math test than the kids who did a neutral picture.
And Bryce's other question about the unintended consequence of affirmative action, which gets it back to a little bit what we were describing before about whether or not those programs do engender a kind of resentment and where you think they ought to be targeted at this point in our American culture.
Yeah. I'm a supporter of affirmative action in higher education. I'm a provost, and I'm committed to it for a variety of reasons. And I think there's a wrong way to do it and a right way to do it. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of times it is done in ways that have negative unintended consequences. And the worst way to do it is to assume that students who are admitted under affirmative action need a great deal of support and to segregate them in academic support programs or remediation programs. This does reify the stereotype in the environment and cause them to be seen that way. And I think it does contribute to some of the underperformance I observed that launched this research. The right way to do it is in the way I described my advisor. Admit them and make the work challenging and demanding and support their abilities to achieve it. Don't admit people who cynically, don't admit people who you don't think can achieve, but this gives you ample opportunity to admit a great number of students. So do that and really demand a lot. Right?
And critical mass still matters.
Yeah, and critical mass still matters.
What about those colleges? Because there's some prestigious liberal arts colleges in the Northeast. I think of the college my daughter went to, actually, Bates College in Maine, and a number of others that have said, we're not taking the SATs. They don't matter.
Yeah.
Is that a direction you'd like to see more colleges go in so that's not part of the bar?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the SAT. As you can imagine, doing this research for 20 years where the dependent measure we've looked at a lot, the measure we've has been standardized test performance. After seeing so many of these irrelevant things have such a big effect on standardized test performance, I worry that this test can really be the fair kind of test that we want it to be or think it is. There's the larger problem about tests, which is that they don't predict very well. They don't really do that well. So it's like picking basketball teams by picking how good kids are at free throws. It's kind of roughly related to the task at hand, but it's not the same thing.
Derek writes in, some years ago when I was a white undergraduate, I had several friends who were black. When the school year ended and we headed our separate ways, we exchanged phone numbers. One black friend told me to let him call me and not to call him because of his parents, apparently because I was white. I was blown away. The feelings of exclusion and dejection that he must feel quite a lot were suddenly cast on me. I'll never forget that. And it's easy to understand, therefore, the premise of your work in Whistling Vivaldi. It's interesting to think about the way in which this cuts back and forth.
Yeah. I describe a story in the book of a student, white student, who told me about the experience of being in an African-American political science class and having the first day focus on the period after slavery and the violence against African-Americans. And he realizes quickly that he's one of only two whites in his class of about 40 or so people. And all of a sudden, he's just immobilized with a certain kind of tension of the sort that the caller describes there, of feeling anything I say here could just be taken the wrong way, and am I really prejudiced? Am I not? Just a lot of internal doubts are created just by being in that kind of situation. So I think it is a good window into each other's the anxieties we can provide we impose on each other.
And how do we begin to climb over that discomfort? You describe in the book the Southwest Airlines example, which is a funny and yet insightful story. Describe that, if you would, and how we can begin to sit next to each other, which is what the Southwest Airlines story is about.
Yeah. It's told by a woman, I'm forgetting her name, she has a book on integration, and it's a story from that book of how she on lining up for Southwest Airlines, where people can go on and take whatever seats they want to take. She hopes that an African-American male will be ahead of her in line because he'll get on, take a good seat, and then nobody else will take the seat next to him. And she is an African-American, will go on and be able to plop down next to him and have a great seat. So why are the other passengers avoiding this person? We actually did research to test this. We were so intrigued by this possibility. I think in big part it's a version of white stereotype threat, that in that situation whites can fear that if they sit next to him and engage in conversation that maybe they can make a mistake and be seen as racially inappropriate or even racist. And they're just trying to get to Detroit. They're not worried. And so they just go get a more comfortable seat. And I think that's one of the forces that can keep us apart, puts a distance between us.
And to Tony in Pinole this morning. Tony, go ahead.
Yeah. Hello, Provost. I had a question. I've experienced a type of negative stereotypes that you've mentioned in academic settings, and so I'm well aware of what you're talking about. But I wanted to know what are you proposing as solutions for this? Because as you mentioned earlier, that there's as you go higher, particularly in the sciences, it becomes even more pronounced.
Yes, much of the research has for the last 10 years has been devoted to solutions. So let me just mention a few and then refer you to the book to put in a naked plug there. But I think one thing what can schools do and what can students going through them do? For you going through them, one important thing comes from the work of a colleague of mine, Carol Dweck, and I refer you to her book. She has a great book on mindset. And it it stresses the importance of viewing ability as expandable and incremental, not as viewing as opposed to viewing ability as something that's fixed. When you think of ability as something that's fixed and God-given or genetically given, then we tend to take frustration as a sign that we don't have the ability, we lose motivation and interest and go away. When you understand that ability is something that will expand with work and effort and focus and organization, then frustration has a very different meaning, and it makes the impact of that stereotype threat a lot less.
Which is also why it's so important to get at what you were describing before about the way in which college professors in particular, to Tony's point in terms of how we can fix this, that they deliver feedback in the right way to say, you know, your essay here, we can get it there. It's expandable, to
That's
use
right.
the phrase you just used.
That's right. I think people really need – this is something we way overuse in our culture, is the idea that ability is a fixed and God-given, genetically given, limiting kind of a capacity, when it's not. Most of the scientific evidence, the brain is the most expandable part of our bodies. It changes as we learn, and it gains capacities. And so we really have to understand abilities that way to free ourselves from these kinds of pressures.
Does that – and Tony, thanks for the call. Does that also get at this question of how we can sit together on Southwest Airlines, that if we look at that as not so much of a this is something I should do, but rather as an expansionary possibility, or let's figure this out together and look at it as kind of a challenge – as opposed to a should, that will help us cross that?
Exactly. I won't go into the details, but we put exactly that idea to test in a number of laboratory experiments, Phil Goff and I. And that's what you find. When you enable people to think about interracial interactions over difficult topics like race and the like, in the case of that research, racial profiling, when you get enable people to think of that in terms of as an opportunity to learn about a different set of perspectives and so on, and something that you can get better and better at, people are a lot more relaxed in those interactions.
Michael has an observation in Berkeley. Michael, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I was a teacher in East Flint, and my students told me that all white people are rich. So what I did was I showed them pictures of my grandfather working in a field with harvest crops. He was a day laborer.
Michael, you're breaking up a little, but I think we got your point, which is that this needs to come at it. Teachers need to think of ways that they can reach their students. Michael sounds like is a white teacher working perhaps with kids of color, and he, as a way of showing them, no, just because I'm white, I'm not rich. I'll show you some pictures of where I came from.
Yeah, that's a great strategy because it shows a common ground, and we feel much more relaxed and safe with people with whom we share common ground. And so I think when teachers can do that, that can be an effective strategy.
Anthony writes in, what about the stereotype of smart kids aren't cool? I used to do a lot of one-on-one math tutoring and found that my students would get problems wrong or not try very hard when they thought they would be seen as not cool because they knew the answer. It's reminiscent of something that Barack Obama said during his first sort of step out into the spotlight in his 2004 speech at the Democratic Convention, where he talked about we have to get to the point where it's okay for black kids to read books.
Yeah, I think that's something that teachers may have a chance to go at more directly than they think. And that is that take as part of the instruction the making of that material as into cool material. I think good teachers do this kind of intuitively, that you show people that it's really cool to know about these things. Over many, many years of teaching, tried to do that in an explicit way. I mean, I was aware of – I have to find a way here that these college students are going to think this statistics or this set of methodology is actually cool and will expand their capacities. And so I think that should be taken as a normal part of teaching.
Let's get in one more question. Sophia in Santa Rosa. Go ahead, Sophia.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I'm a college professor, and I always want my students to do their best so that I give them an opportunity to resubmit papers. And I sit down with them and show them how to improve the papers. But it's been interesting because in some cases with my black students, they don't trust me. They don't want to come. They just have this attitude, I don't believe you. And at the beginning, it hurt me. But now I accept there is probably a history, but I don't give up. I keep, and I say, okay, you have to come to my office hours, and because I know you can do better.
Sophia, let me hold you there because we're quite short on time, but I'm curious to hear, Claude Steele, what you would advise perhaps, Sophia, to sort of break through that level of distrust.
Yeah, I think her persistence is exactly the right thing to do. And to if there's any coaching I might give, it would be to remember to affirm their abilities to, not in a direct way, but in an implicit way, to make those tutoring sessions demanding. I think you can really achieve something in this work if the work is presented to them as that kind of a challenge that you think they can meet. I think that can help you be effective there. But I'd also want to just affirm the strategy of being as persistent as you're being there. I think that over time builds a kind of trusting relationship that will enable you to succeed.
Are you optimistic at this point about where we can go from here?
I am optimistic. I'm optimistic about where we can go. If you ask me to... If you put a time frame of 20 years, well, I don't know. That's, but I think we're going in the right direction. I am 64, and I've lived through some amazing changes, and so I think that's part of where my optimism comes from. But I think the unraveling of these kind of processes will help us. I'd like to think this kind of work makes that kind of contribution, that it helps us understand things that will gradually wisen up our ways of improving these things, and that we really will make a progress. We're taking on a task no other society has ever taken on, trying to have a really genuinely integrated society, and this is part of it, trying to understand these things.
And maybe someday all sitting together on Southwest Airlines.
Yeah.
Claude Steele, his book again, Whistling Vivaldi and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lorberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Nadia Arid, Elena Kadavny, David Murder, and Ariel Niedermeyer. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.